Coaching session 15. We start from the presumption that our people are talented and want to contribute. We accept that without meaning to, our company is stifling that talent in myriad unseen ways. Finally, we try to identify those impediments and fix them. That's a quote. But I'm betting that that's not how it works in your organization. And it's not because I'm picking on your organization. It's just because it's so rare. Business and organizational leaders, they read books like Good to Great, and then they get on a kick to become great, but never do. Or they read the innovator's DNA, and they're hoping to cultivate or find some DNA in themselves that mean they're innovative, but you know, they never do. Why? Well, because preconceived notions are tough to overcome. And the notions, they're really not notions. They're really much more than that. They're beliefs. And beliefs are part of business intelligence or strategic planning or performance appraisals or any of that other hard analytic kind of stuff that we pride ourselves in. Well, fact is, it's easier to speak about and to hear about those hard facts and those logic-based tools, because we can wrap our head around a spreadsheet, you know, that shows us, well, hey, this line item right here, it's out of whack. It's tough to come to grips, though, with the belief that those guys down in the warehouse, they're stealing from us every chance they get. It's even tougher to be confronted with the truth that our belief about those warehouse guys drives our behavior and our business decisions about those guys and their work. About 20 years ago, I had a friend who was part of the management team for General Electric's major home appliance division here in Dallas. And Jack Welch was the big cheese at GE at the time, and I was a big fan. I had read anything and everything I could about the man, and my friend knew that I was a fan, so he invited me to join a few local business people to have a meet and greet with Welch at the Galleria Hotel in Dallas. Herb Kelleher was running Southwest Airlines at the time. He was there, along with dozens of other business guys who made me feel like a fish out of water, but I was honored to be part of the group. Well, we sat in a small conference room where probably no more than 50 people had gathered to hear Welch impart some business wisdom before the meet and greet. For many years, GE had been known as a giant in innovation and leadership training and strategy. And so Welch began by telling us about a trip that he had taken to Japan. He told us about the bullet train, you know, that high-speed train that's been part of the Japanese landscape for years. Well, Welch told us how the Japanese approach problem-solving very differently than we do here in America. I had read and studied Edward Deming's work in Japan following the end of World War II, so I knew how that country had risen to manufacturing powerhouse status after the war, in large part to Deming's work toward continuous improvement. But still, I was fascinated by Welch's story. When the problem is stated, it presents the challenge pretty clearly. How can we safely engineer a train that will travel at 200 miles an hour? Well, the Americans, Welch confessed, immediately start thinking about the locomotives. That was a business, by the way, that GE was in. They start considering, how can we make engines and other components that will reliably propel a train that fast? The Japanese, on the other hand, he said, they start thinking about something very different. No, they don't think about the engine. I mean, they don't even think about the track. They start thinking about the bed upon which the track must be built. What kind of bed would you need for a track that could sustain a train reliably day after day at 200 miles an hour? That's clearly a different approach. Americans believe the problem is horsepower and propulsion. The Japanese believe the problem is literally a ground-up kind of a problem. And those varied beliefs, well, those very beliefs drive how they solve problems. At least that problem. Well, during a quick Q&A, Kelleher asked Welch a question about strategic planning, and I had read so much about Welch, I already knew his response, but it was delightful to hear him answer the question anyway. And Kelleher asked him, what's strategic planning, what's that like at GE? And Welch, in his usual New England-style bluntness, said, it's pretty simple. We look at the competition and try to find out what they can do in the next 18 months to nail us to the wall. And then we look at ourselves and try to figure out what we can do in the next 18 months to nail them to the wall. That's our strategic planning. Jack's belief that all the glitz and the glitter that Wall Street looks for in strategic planning is mostly bull led him to force a more practical, real-world approach to GE during his watch. For him, it was about market share. For him, it was about GE being number one or number two in every business that they operated. If you ran a division of GE that was number three in market share, then you were in serious trouble, because it meant that two other competitors, at least, were nailing you to the wall. And so Jack would close businesses or he would sell them off. That's why he earned the nickname Neutron Jack, because he would jettison people, entire divisions, who were part of a losing business. And he'd leave only the building standing. The CEO who believes every employee is lazy and dishonest is going to operate very differently than the president of Pixar, a guy by the name of Ed Catmull. That's his quote at the beginning. Pixar began in 1979 as part of Lucasfilm. They were the graphics group. Now they're best known for CGI animations. Steve Jobs became a majority shareholder in 1986. And in 2006, Walt Disney Company bought them for $7.4 billion. They have produced 14 feature films, earning over $8.5 billion and 27 Academy Awards, 7 Golden Globes, and 11 Grammy Awards. Dr. Catmull is the founding member of the company. And by all accounts, he's as brilliant in business creativity and leadership as he is in computers. And his quote is, well, it bears repeating, so here it is. We start from the presumption that our people are talented and want to contribute. We accept that without meaning to, our company is stifling that talent in myriad unseen ways. Finally, we try to identify those impediments and fix them. Well, it's just genius, isn't it? What are your starting presumptions? Now, I want you to think very seriously about these. I don't want you to censor them. I don't want you to spruce them up to what you think they ought to be. I want you to face them as they really exist. What are your starting presumptions? It's likely that you've not even thought of this. Do you presume that most people are lazy and apathetic? Do you presume that most people, they really don't care if they do good work or not? They just show up for a job and a paycheck. Do you presume that most people will neglect work unless somebody is there to constantly force them? Do you presume that most people will give only an average performance unless there's consistent pressure daily applied? These are all very common presumptions, by the way, of leaders. Ironically, these are not the presumptions of highly innovative, creative, and remarkable organizations. That may explain why so few organizations fit those descriptions. What are the things you accept about yourself and your organization? Again, think soberly about these things and be truthful with yourself. It's not going to help you to con yourself. Dr. Catmull accepts that, without meaning to, Pixar is stifling talent in a variety of ways. He accepts that. Do you accept that your company is doing everything possible to help employees succeed? Do you accept that every leader is providing the support and the training necessary to fully develop people? Do you accept that all of your processes and your systems are flawless, but the people are flawed? Now, again, you judge for yourself simply by using your own career experience. Examine your own career and look at the bosses and the culture in your background. How would you describe your experiences? Have most of your bosses shown you how it's done? Or have you, like so many of the rest of us, learned how not to do it? Whenever I ask this question, the universal answer leans toward the negative. I mean, most people can easily talk about the impossible bosses or the distasteful cultures. Some can point out a remarkable boss, but most of them can't. Some can talk about a culture that was conducive to innovation, learning, and excelling, but most can't. In fact, many people think these are fictional concepts found only in business books. I've run across a number of people who doubt that such leaders or cultures even exist in the real world. That's pretty sad. So let's end on action. Dr. Catmull identifies Pixar's actions. Finally, he says, we try to identify those impediments and fix them. What is your company trying to identify and fix? Are you trying to find out who failed so you can fire them? Are you trying to find out who made the mistake so you can castigate them? Are you trying to lay blame somewhere so you can avoid having the finger pointed at your department? Again, these are beliefs that drive our performance, and they impact everything that happens in our organizations. Leaders show us the way, either toward heightened paranoia or toward greater faith. You are a leader, and that's why it's important and urgent that you spend some time examining your beliefs and looking at how they're helping or hindering your excellence. And fixing those beliefs, well, that's a different topic for another day. For now, you've just got to make up your mind to correctly identify your beliefs and think about the impact, negative or positive, that they're having on your career, your organization, your people, your culture. We'll talk again soon.